Today, we're delving into the creepy corridors of the 1988 horror cult classic Waxworks, a film that dared to bring together a macabre collection of terrifying monsters and creatures, blending horror in an homage that's left an indelible mark on the genre. Join us as we explore the origins of the sinister Wax Museum, the creative mind of writer and director Anthony Hickox. We'll also examine the film's enduring legacy as a cult favorite, so lock your doors, dim the lights, and prepare to enter a world where the line between wax and reality begins to blur. All that today and more here on Patio Commentary. Hi, my name is Matt Jarbo. Welcome back to another episode of Patio Commentary. Today on the show, we're going to be diving into the 1988 horror comedy Waxwork. This is one that was a sponsored episode by a listener of Hollywood After Dark. So thank you very much for that, HBarts. And this is one that I will fully admit I hadn't seen until just the other day. I was aware of its existence. But I, you know, as not really a kid who watched a lot of horror movies, when it came out, you know, I saw the cover of it and it just kind of frightened me. You know, it's a freaky little cover, right? It is. For a kid, it's a freaky little cover. But I, you know, missed it. And it's one that I get to visit at the age of 40. And that's perfectly okay because this movie is actually really solid. I had a lot of fun watching it, even though it's, you know, you could totally tell that its budget was very, very little. And you can tell that they were just really trying to cram as much in there as they could. When you start getting into like how the movie was made, you kind of start to realize why it's framed the way that it is. The overall story is really interesting, but it lacks a lot of depth. Now, that could be something that gets more explained in the sequel, Lost in Time, which I do have a copy of, thanks to HBarts, but I actually haven't watched yet. I'll cover that at a later date. And this is just one of those stories. I'm watching it, and I'm like, there's a really unique tale contained within this movie that is unfortunately kind of bogged down by just set piece after set piece. But that being said, the set pieces are really good. So it's just like, it's a weird mix of things. And that's why I do ultimately feel that this movie is largely like as fun as it is to watch, right? So for those of you who don't know how the show operates, I talk about the synopsis of the movie. I talk about how it was made. I give my thoughts on the overall movie. And then I talk about its critical and box office response, as well as its legacy. If you want to support the show, the best way to do that is head over to patiocommentary.com. Check it out there. There's patreon.com/Matt Jarbo. We're on Twitter at Patio Commentary, and probably soon going to be on TikTok as Patio Commentary as well. I just haven't set it up yet. I just need to. So with that out of the way, let's dive into the movie. So again, Waxworks, like I said, is a 1988 horror comedy film about a group of college students who stumble into a mysterious wax museum. Once inside, they discover that the exhibits are more than just wax figures. They are portraits to different worlds where various monsters come to life. As the students are sucked into each exhibit, they must fight for their lives against werewolves, vampires, zombies, and more. The movie is directed by Anthony Hickox and stars Zach Galligan, you know, from Gremlins, Deborah Foreman, Michelle Johnson, David Warner, Dana Ashbrook, and Patrick McNee. A lot of those names you probably don't recognize, and that's entirely okay. This is very much a low-budget movie that is not going to have a lot of big stars in it, right? But let's talk about the writer and director, this being Anthony Hickox, because Hickox is most known for his work in the horror genre. You know, he's directed several movies over the years. Like I said, Waxworks 2, Lost in Time. There was The Sundown, Vampire in Retreat. He did Hellraiser 3, Hell on Earth, and Warlock Armageddon. He's worked on multiple films, even like more recently. He's worked with like Steven Seagal. He's worked with Eddie Griffin. He does a lot of these like, you know, mid-budget, straight-to-DVD action films that have just found an audience. And that's kind of where he stayed. But really, it was Waxworks that kind of put him on the map. And it did also launch his career. So it's pretty funny how he kind of came to do this because, you know, there's not a lot of information that's available for how the movie ultimately came together that's not in like an hour and a half documentary that was on the double disc DVD release. And I will fully admit I did not get the opportunity to watch that. So I had to go do some digging online, and this is what I found. There's a nice interview where Hickox kind of dives into the various aspects of making Waxwork. Basically, the main motivation behind writing the script was he needed money He needed money. He was told he needed to come up with a script in just a couple days in order to get paid. Now, look, I've been there when I was in LA. I needed money. I was brought in for a couple quick jobs. They were terrible, but you need to get paid. And if that money's on the table, you freaking take it, right? But anyway, the concept for Waxworks came to Anthony from an urban legend about spending a night in a chamber of horrors, as well as Hickox's own passion for Hammer horror monsters. Anthony Hickox now says that the movie was designed to have a bit of a comedic touch because it was heavily inspired by Tales from the Crypt. There was a lot of the storyboards that for the movie were very much drawn with that in mind. And I understand that they are probably going to make that argument now because of how Waxworks 2 kind of turned out. But I don't think you can look at this movie and in any actual way say that it's a comedy, a horror comedy. Like, you're not laughing for the reasons you should be laughing, if you're laughing at all. And I'll be honest with you, the only time in the movie I was kind of like chuckling, like, this is so bad it's good sort of thing, is just the final fight scene, which in and of itself only happened because of a budgetary, you know, running out of money, essentially. But other than that, like, the set pieces were cool. The setup was interesting. It had tension builds. Yeah, it was predictable, but it wasn't one that I would argue had like a horror comedy element to it. You know, like, there was a movie I talked about recently that also had the same title of horror comedy. And I'm like, no, the movie played it entirely straight. This movie plays it entirely straight. And I find that to be frustrating when I look back at some of these films that get dubbed a horror comedy, because I feel like a horror comedy is something like Shaun of the Dead, where it's able to build the tension and then have those tension breaks with actual genuine moments of laughter that are designed to be comedic rather than just accidents of the trade. It's like people who say that The Room is a comedy. No, The Room is so bad it's funny. It's also so bad it's legitimately good. But the reason why The Room works is because they played it straight. Tommy Wiseau made that movie as a drama, as a hard drama. And it's what came from it that gave it its designation. And I feel that when we look at a lot of these movies, I really feel this. Like, if we look at a lot of these movies, we have to look at how that they were made in the moment. What the director was intentionally trying to do in the moment, and then assess it from that perspective. When we remove that, when we take that away, when we go into something else and we try to apply, I don't know, almost like a get out of jail free card to an extent, I'm going to be like, you know, yeah, it's not really going to work out. You know what I mean? Like, oh, yeah, no, like Cocaine Bear, for example, I've talked about recently. I didn't really care for it because Cocaine Bear, it was played so straight that the comedy elements that it promised me in the trailer were just not there. It really did try to just play up being a horror. And that's something that it wasn't was. Also, Megan is another one, too. They call Megan a horror comedy. Right, we have two of these examples from 2023, two movies that are like a horror comedy, and you're watching them and you're like, these are like played relatively straight. You know, Megan is in no way a comedy, not in any bit. Cocaine Bear is definitely not a comedy in the way that it was come together. It tries to be funny, but the funny comes, the trailer marketed that movie as a comedy. There was no even cocaine humor in the movie necessarily outside of one scene. And again, it was like, okay, whatever. I don't want to dwell on Cocaine Bear because we're talking about Waxworks. But what I mean is just like when they get these movies get that designation, it kind of makes me a little bit frustrated because I'm like, no, like it's marketing. It's all marketing. And so they kind of say that in regards to Waxworks as well. You know, and again, they're trying to argue that because of the Tales from the Crypt comics and Hickox's own admiration for Mel Brooks movies because he loves Young Frankenstein, that this movie was somewhat pulling from those. Go and watch it again without that in mind. Just look at it as a straight movie and you'll be like, no, those elements simply do not exist. But here it is nearly 40 years later. No one cares. And I'm just kind of arguing for the sake of arguing. But anyway, let's get back into this here. So he needed money. He needed to write a script. He came up with this idea super fast. He wrote it. They got $3 million to make the movie, which is just like insane. For how much? I think he equated it in a recent interview to being roughly about $500,000 by today's money. So yeah, like that's kind of the idea there. But anyway, the production of Waxworks did face several challenges due to the budgetary and time limitations. Like I said before, the climactic fight scene at the end had to be improvised as the producers were threatening to shut down the movie. This actually, unfortunately, led Hickox to abandon his original idea of having a fight through time sequence, which he was actually later able to, I guess, put into Waxworks 2, according to this article that I read. The film's special effects were particularly challenging to execute, such as the werewolf, which required a large number of crew members to operate various parts of the creature, and apparently the blue light effect for when they get pushed into the portal took very, very many attempts to get correct. But let me just say this, though. Let me just, before I dive into the werewolf was awesome. The werewolf was great. John Rhys Davies was awesome just in, like, the little bit he was in the movie. And, like, the werewolf was, like, legitimately freaky. You know, it was legitimately freaky. I thought it was great. And I'll talk more about that when we get to the plot. But, like, again, the aesthetics of the movie, yeah, the set design, you could totally tell, like, it's actual cardboard in some cases. But, like, the aesthetics of the film were awesome. Like, I had so much fun watching the different set pieces. I just wish there was a bit more of a cohesive narrative, especially leading into that final battle that just kind of seems to come out of the left field, very much like the ending of Monty Python and the Search for the Holy Grail, you know, just not as jarring. And I hate the ending of Monty Python and the Holy Grail. I don't know why. I just hate it. Love the movie up till the end, but this did not have that. This was just like, I was like, okay, they're just burning down the sets now. Let's just do this. Anyway, the waxwork itself featured a few of these creatures, but like that we get to spend some time with. But largely, it did have 18 of the most evil beings in the world from like various horror films as well as kind of history, with many characters inspired by Hammer-style monsters. Some of the characters had more abstract origins, like the Golem, which is based on one of Hickox's childhood favorites. You see him briefly in the movie. He's just kind of in the background. I actually had to Google it after looking that up, reading this article that I'm pulling from, because I'm like, where was the Golem in this? And then I saw it. I'm like, okay, it's that one there. But additionally, the special effects makeup by Bob Keane has been highly praised over the years, but the team was like super careful to not run amok and go too crazy and get Universal Pictures on their ass, right? They had to be like very, very careful to not copy anything too directly because of legal issues. And I mean, yeah, Universal monsters are very iconic. They are very distinct in their, you know, look. And so they had to be careful. And here they did a pretty good job, right? Like, you wouldn't think that it would be something that would come from Universal, right? It's not like the Monster Squad, which one of the things that Anthony Hickox did have to kind of deal with in the beginning of this was that he was worried, or someone, one of the producers was worried, really, that the movie was too close to the Monster Squad, which had come out the year before. And look, the Monster Squad is Goonies with Universal horror monsters. Like, that's what it is, right? It's one of my all-time favorite movies, you know, to give you guys a bit of an anecdote on that one. And I'll talk about that again when I do my Monster Squad episode. But when I was a kid, I loved Monster Squad so much, I recorded the audio of the movie on a dual-sided cassette tape, and I would listen to it as I fell asleep. That is how much I loved Monster Squad as a kid. And one of the reasons why I just love movies, I just love all facets of them, is if you can get me to listen to the audio of a movie and just find enjoyment off of that, you've got me as a fan. When I worked at a drive-in, I was a manager of a drive-in for a long time in San Diego, the Santee drive-in. And when I would work, we would have the radio to listen to the movies to make sure that everything was running just fine. And when we had Inglourious Basterds playing in 2009, I would just listen to the movie, like repeatedly, just listen to the movie as it was on. Half the movie is in another language. I think like three different languages in the movie. And I would just like listen because I just loved the dialogue. I loved the performances. I loved how it played out. I'm very auditory on that front. And so if a movie can grab me on that level, I'm very happy. That's why I love Monster Squad. And this movie actually did a fair amount of that as well. I thought the musical choices were pretty cool, like contemporary for the 80s. I think they used Swan Lake. At one point, I'm listening to the movie, and I forget the score it used, but like it sounded like very, like it sounded epic and massive. And I just forget what it is right now, but I remember going like, oh, wow, that's actually like really cool. I really enjoyed that. And I even really enjoy some of the cinematography in the movie as well. Like when the werewolf scene happens and the guy, John, I think his name is, when he dies, the way that the camera just immediately cuts back to it being part of the waxwork and how it seems seamless, I thought was really, really, really good. So there's like a lot of really cool little moments in this movie that are just like very aesthetically pleasing. And that is one of the reasons why it's like just a fun movie to watch. And if you are curious where to watch it right now, I know I'm halfway through the episode and I'm telling you this, Tubi has got part one and part two. That's where it's streaming. You can go and check it out there. But anyway, let's get back to this here. So one of the key things that Hickox really liked was the Marquis de Sade segment of the movie. By his own admission, he's a pervert. By his own admission. And he even plays the English prince who's watching the Marquis go to town, right? He's the one watching that. He's the one who has that real kind of dirty, creepy, perverted look on his face. And that's Anthony Hickox. And apparently the Marquis de Sade scene was what really triggered people. According to him, he wanted to expand it into a standalone feature at some point in time, but that never materialized. But what's funny is the Marquis de Sade scene actually got a lot of mixed responses from the audience. Hickox had said that he received a ton of letters, like hate mail, from people who were really upset at the scene and how the violence against Sarah was depicted. But then he said he also got a bunch of mail from young girls who thought the scene was really hot. And this, by the way, is well before 50 Shades of Grey and that entire weird phenomenon that happened like 10 years ago. I'll do a deep dive into the 50 Shades franchise for those of you who don't know. That shit's weird. That's all I'm going to say about that one. So the movie ultimately came out in the summer of 1988, and well, it had mixed responses, but we're going to get to that there. Let's talk about the movie itself, because the plot, like I said, the plot is interesting because it ends up being this mishmash of scenes cobbled together to tell this overall story. And again, it follows kind of every trope in the book. You know, the protagonist of the movie is Mark Loughmore, played by Zach Galligan, who is an affluent white boy. He's a rich boy. You know, it starts off and he's like, "Mother, I would like my coffee with breakfast." And she's like, "Oh, Pookins, no." You know, and then he walks out and his butler's like, "Here's your coffee, sir, or your caffeine, and then here's your nicotine." And he lights his cigarette and he gives him coffee and he's like, "Would you like your wheels today, sir?" You know, "No, thanks, G, I'll walk." You know, and then he just like leaves his home and he walks to what appears to be a college. And this is where we meet the rest of the gang. You've got Sarah, you've got China. You know, there's James. It's James, not John. That's my bad. You got Tony. You got Jim. I mean, it's like that's the friends, right? That's the friend group that's there. And, you know, they're all kind of just like suburbanite, affluent, whatever. Like Mark is having a beef with China because the two of them had hooked up. They had broken up. He's not over it yet. And she's basically just like, "I'm going to go and sleep with whomever I want." And she's going to rub his face in it. And that she knows it makes him jealous. Right. She knows it makes him jealous. But the whole time, too, you've got Sarah, who's like the mousy friend who's clearly pining for Mark and obviously setting up the hero and heroine of the story. And it's just one of those things where it's like, OK, we're kind of in like this very tropey world. They're setting it up. You largely don't like any of the characters to begin with. Like Mark is unlikable. And I think that's an interesting choice to make Mark largely unlikable in the movie, because when you're trying to, you know, support the main character, you want to see them succeed. In the first half of the film, Mark could have died and I would have been like, "Yeah, okay, cool. I get it. He's a dick. He's a total dick. He's a jackass. Like, we don't want this at all. Let's not have it." But there's really no character in the movie that would replace him. So he kind of has to be that hero. But at the same time, he kind of has to go on a journey of his own. The downside to that is, though, is that the journey is, it's kind of like, you know, it's, I don't know, it's not the best that's there. Because, the problem with the movie is just, like, it's the set pieces, right? You're watching it for the set pieces. So you've got, like, you know, China and Sarah, and they're walking to school, and they end up encountering the guy who owns the waxwork, and he invites them for a private showing and says no more than six people. they end up like going and getting everyone to come on in at night. But Gemma and I think Tony, they bail out. They're like, oh, no, we're not going to stay. We're not going to stay. They get too scared and they leave. So now there's only four of them. And then they go in and they're walking around. And yeah, all the designs look really cool. You see like the mummy. You see the Marquis de Sade. You see Dracula. There's like, you know, Jack the Ripper. There's like Rosemary's Baby. There's a bunch of these like different designs that you see that are very Cabin in the Woods like. If I have to compare it to anything, I think Cabin in the Woods took a lot from Waxworks, if you want my honest opinion. Like now that I think about Cabin in the Woods and like when they go at the end and you see all those different creatures from different folklore or different monsters or whatever, like all of those tropey type murderers, that's what's in this room. But I thought that was really cool because like when I was a kid, my stepmom worked for Ripley's, believe it or not, in Newport Beach, Oregon. And so every time I went down to go visit my dad, I would get to go to Ripley's, believe it or not, all the time. So going around and hanging around like the Waxworks and everything else, like for me as a kid, was really cool. So to go back into it with this movie, I thought was really awesome as well, because just to like to see everything. And then, of course, you know, you've got Tony, right? Oh, it was Tony. It wasn't James. My bad. I got it wrong. You got Tony who goes into the werewolf scene. And that was actually really interesting. That's the first one we go into. And I liked it quite a bit because he's just like walking through the woods. There's a cabin. There's John Rhys Davies and the moon's out, you know. And then, of course, he turns into the werewolf and they fight. And then here come like the hunters. And like, it's so funny because he just tells the one guy, he's like, go distract him while I try to load these silver bullets that aren't already loaded by the time we get here. And then the werewolf just like crushes that dude's head and then legitimately tears him in half. And I thought that was like so cool. Just tears him in half. While Tony is just watching like he's got bit on the arm. He's like, ah, you know, and he's just watching from the sides. And then, of course, the hunter kills the werewolf. And then Tony immediately starts to turn. That got me thinking about the idea of American Werewolf in London, where it's like, if you kill the werewolf that turned you, the curse is broken, right? If that werewolf dies, the curse is broken. Well, I mean, like, they didn't do that, you know? So, it's like, well, they did do that, but then he immediately turned anyway. And then before he was able to finish transformation, the hunter kills him. And that's when we have the shot of Tony dying in an immediately cutting, like it, the camera just turns and you're back in the Waxworks. And the way that they are able to like match the set design, this or that shot, I should say, I thought was really cool because you don't see it coming. And that's why that particular camera trick really, really worked for me. Yeah, I'm going to applaud it constantly. I think it was great. From there, China's walking around and she sees the vampire. She ends up like going into that and she is in this vampire castle or this old like Romanian castle, Transylvanian castle, whatever. We meet Dracula, you know, and that scene was weird too because that guy could not act to save his damn life. You know, it was very like I understand they're going for more of like a dreamy type sequence for the dinner scene. But then it's like they bring out the steak tartare and I'm like, yeah, there's something about that steak tartare. She's like, I haven't had it in forever. And they're like, oh, it's do you want it? She's all like, yeah, I guess I'll take the sauce. And, it, you know, he's like, it's a bit salty. And you're like, okay, that's very, very unique thing to say for this specific dish. And, you know, of course she eats it, goes to the room. The sun comes in, you know, the vampire thing. She runs away. And then she goes and she finds like her supposed husband, right? And the way it's shot, and again, I love the way that it was shot. It was shot like all you see is everything is in darkness except for blood on the table. And you're like, yo, they were eating this dude's leg. Like you immediately make the connection that they were eating this dude's leg. And then she turns the lights on and he's just, oh my God, like just from his knee, his calf, his ankle, it's all just bone. And he's just chained to the table. And I was like, this is awesome. This is great. It was so cool, you know? And then like, as this dude is like tore up, he is literally telling her how to survive. Like that to me was so cool because he's just like, you know, it's like, you have to like, you know, use a crucifix or like decapitation, you know? And then like, here comes the sun vampire and everything. And she gets two knives and, you know, he's impervious to that, but she puts it as a crucifix and puts it to his head and his head just explodes. I was like, yes, that was great. Oh, that was great. And again, the whole time, the guy is just like, he's, you know, completely cognizant of what's happening and he's lost his leg. But then, like, here come the other, you know, the other brides of Dracula, whatever, right? And then that guy turns and then she runs and then, you know, she gets stopped by Dracula and then he just uses his, you know, eye power on her, right? His hypnotic vision in order to kill her. And but what I really enjoyed about that, though, is that, like, she had the fight. She had the fight. She had the fight to be a final girl. She did. She had the fight, but she still got caught in the trap. You know what I mean? And it just shows you that it doesn't really matter what it is. You can still get got in these scenarios. And I thought that was really, really, really interesting. I enjoyed that quite a bit, you know. And then from there, obviously, you've got, like, you know, Mark and Sarah, and they're like, where did they go? And, you know, there's the insinuation that Tony and China are off bumping pelvises somewhere. And obviously this just makes Mark angry. So he's like, let's just get out of here, you know? And then at the same time, you've got, like, the boyfriend, or, like, well, the jock that China was sleeping with is trying to find her. So he calls her house at, like, literally 2 a.m. and doesn't, like, her mom's like, oh, she's not even home. And he's all, like, pounding the side of the phone booth, you know, like a weird kind of grapist, I guessed, right? And then she says where they're at, and he just says, oh, I'll go find it. And he goes in there, and then just, I love it. He sneaks in. All right. He sneaks in, and then he ends up encountering the bad guy. And the bad guy just pushes him into the Jack the Ripper scene, or no, the Phantom of the Opera scene. And then we don't see what happened. We just immediately see that he's dead as a constable. And now he's in the waxwork. And again, like, just how fast and instantaneous it was really interesting, because what that shows you, just from, like, a perspective, is that how fast it happens and how time has no effect. So once you go into the waxwork, once you go into that world, time stops for you effectively, right? And so when you exit or when you die, it's instantaneous on the other side of that. So that to me is, like, really cool. I thought it was a great way to cut around having to actually film it, but it still made it really interesting to watch it play out. And then from there, obviously, you know, Mark goes to the cops and he's trying to let them know something is happening. And he's obviously worried, but he's not worried necessarily because he's upset that China may be off having sex with somebody else. He is legitimately starting to care about just her well-being. So this is where we start seeing a little bit of his change. And I think a lot of that has to do with Sarah, by the way, because Sarah tells him, like, I like you, you know, and he leans in to kiss her. And she's like, but I don't want that. I don't want this. Right. And she shuts him down, but she does it in a nice way. And he kind of just goes, okay. Like, yeah, okay. That's okay. And that is, like, the first real moment you start to see his character come out in a way that's not being an affluent piece of crap. And I thought that was a nice character twist for him. I really enjoyed that, you know? And so of course he goes to the cops and you just get this, like, total stereotypical LA detective type guy, right? Who just, like, goes down there and, you know, like, looks around and doesn't see anything. He's in and he's out in 2 minutes. But then we get this cutaway a little bit later where he's at his desk and he'd been talking about how there had been 13 other missing people that have happened in the last 2 weeks. So obviously, and again, as you learn, they need to have 666, right? 3 batches of 6. So to unleash the devil, to release Satan under the world is effectively what's happening here. But he starts seeing that the people who are missing are the bodies that he saw in the waxworks. Of course, we get no information on this. Like, it's so rapid how he comes to that conclusion. It's really funny. Like, it really is. Like, it's just, they need to move the plot along. Like, okay, we need to get to the next act. Let's not even, like, worry about this. Let's just set this guy up to go to another scene. And I will fully admit, like, I really enjoy what happened because he goes into the mummy scene. He gets shoved in. He goes in there, gets, you know, buried alive by the mummy, which is great. And then during the final battle later, when everybody comes out, he's still in the sarcophagus. And you just see his hand trying to, like, move around. And he's clearly evil. He's dead at this point. But what's so funny about that is just, like, we don't get any conclusion on that. He's just still stuck inside the sarcophagus. And that's where he is at until the end of the movie. But then, of course, like, his partner comes on in. And the lurch, right, the tall butler, just kills him, right, just snaps his neck. And then, like, the bad guy just starts yelling at him, like, you don't know your own strength. He's useless to us now. And then just goes cavalierly, just get rid of the body. Just take it away. It's just like, it's so, like, the emotions are all over the place, obviously. I think it was great, you know. But then, you know, Sarah and Mark decide to go back in there. They go to Mark's house. And this is where things take a turn that I really like where things turn. But again, we don't get a lot of explanation. So they go into the attic of Mark's house, which is where, you know, his grandfather collected a lot of these artifacts, right? And his grandfather had been murdered 40 years earlier, and it was suspected that it was from his business partner. His business partner happens to be the guy who runs the waxwork, but he hasn't aged a day in 40 years. So then they go talk. Then what it is as well is, like, Sarah finds this book from the Marquis de Sade, and she's also, I should point out, she's a virgin. She's a virgin. They kind of, like, make that abundantly clear. She is drawn to the Marquis de Sade. She very much, like, she's like, sex without pain is, like, not worth having. She kind of quotes him, or I'm paraphrasing, you know. And then she finds this book, and she opens the book, and the book starts having its power over her, you know, and where she starts, like, cold sweat, and she's just getting into it, you know. And I thought that was kind of interesting as a way to showcase these, like, magic relics, so to speak. But again, unless I'm completely missing something, we simply did not get any of this stuff, right? David Lincoln is the chief assistant, the guy who runs the waxwork. That's what his name is, okay? So the two of them then go and see Sir Wilfred, who is Mark's godfather, right? Grandfather's BFF, basically. And he explains that him and Mark's grandfather had collected, if you will, these 18 artifacts from the most evil people who have ever lived, and that Lincoln, who now runs the waxworks, stole the artifact, sold his soul to the devil, and wants to bring back those people to life by creating wax effigies of them and feeding them the souls of victims, which is actually a concept found in voodoo. And the belief here is that by feeding them the souls of these victims would then bring about the voodoo end of the world, and that the dead shall rise and consume all living things, which is interesting, to be honest with you. Quick question, though. Like, did werewolves exist? Did vampires exist? Like, how did these things play out? Which then leads me to believe that in this world, yeah, these things had all existed at one point in time. So Sir Wilfred tells them that the only thing they're able to do is burn down the waxworks before he can complete the rituals and unleash hell on the earth. And that if anything survives, it's game over, right? That's what it is. So they go back to the waxworks and they go, screw it, we're going to burn it all down. But Sarah gets pushed into the Marquis de Sade display, and Mark gets pushed into the zombies. And this is where, again, I thought this was great, because the zombies is very Night of the Living Dead. It's so inspired by George Romero. It's just, it's 100% Night of the Living Dead, and it's great. And it's a great little scene. It's all black and white, very atmospheric. But it's here that Mark realizes that it's not real. And that if you don't let fear get to you, if you realize that it's not real, you can make your way through and nothing they can do will harm you. So he gets out, and then he ends up, you know, running into the Marquis de Sade. At this point in time, Sarah has been brutally beaten, whipped by a cat in nine tails, and the Marquis de Sade is going to kill her for the prince in order to get the prince off, which is, by the way, also the director of the movie is playing that role. And by his own admission, he's a pervert, like I said. So, you know, Mark saves the day. They get out of there. And the Marquis is like, you know, this isn't over. We're going to, like, I'll find you again sort of thing. And you're like, setting up a final battle. So Mark escapes with Sarah. And as they're getting out, they get grabbed by both of the butlers and everything as James and Gemma come into the waxworks, having been called to come find their friends. And they immediately become the zombie and the victim of the Marquis de Sade, which then completes the ritual. Lincoln then resurrects everything as all of these guys bust into the room, this being like Sir Wilfred and a whole bunch of old people who you've never met and you know nothing about, but there's going to be this massive brawl to save the world. And of course, there is. It's a massive fight, and you really don't know which way is up. They literally shot this, I think, in like a day or a couple hours. It was just like they shot this thing so rapidly that there's not a lot of, like, continuity. It feels like it's just a brawl. It's a mess. It's a hard scene to watch. It really is. It's in my mind, it's like the worst timing of the movie. It's the worst part of the movie, in my opinion, just because it doesn't make a lot of sense. But as the Marquis is, you know, chasing after Mark, and Mark is trying to go after Lincoln to stop him from completing the ceremony and ending the world and everything, They get into a fight. The Marquis going to overpower him, but then Sarah shows up, stabs him in the back with a hatchet, which is just, you know, apropos for what happened, right? Just juxtaposition, you know, payback's a bitch sort of thing. And then right as Lincoln's going to kill them, Wilfred shoots him. And Lincoln has got a grease gun. He's got a World War II grease gun, it looks like. And he's just like, oh, what I love about the shot is he's just opening fire. So all these squibs are going off. And then he just slow-mo falls into the vat of wax. And as he does that, the fires start to rage into the house. And Sir Wilfred tells Mark to get Sarah and get out of there as the werewolf comes up behind him and just pulls his head clean off. And there's even an ADR cut that has, you can listen to it. Sir Wilfred is basically saying, like screaming as his, after his head gets pulled off, and they just left it in the movie, which is pretty funny. And then, you know, from there they get out, the house starts to burn down with some very terrible visual effects, and the house burns down and they think the movie's over. You think everything's safe. You think it's all good, but the hand from the zombie hand gets away, obviously leading into the sequel. And that's Waxworks. It's a fine, fun movie. It really is. There's a lot of good stuff there, but it did, you know, like talking about the critical side of things, it received mixed responses back when it came out. Some critics appreciated the blend of horror and comedy, and others criticized it for being too silly and not scary enough. But like I said, you got to approach it from the perspective of which it was created, which was as a horror movie. So on that note, it wasn't scary, but it was intriguing. And the comedy, I believe, is unintentional. Rotten Tomatoes, on the other hand, gives it a 60% approval based only on 10 reviews. But then again, keep in mind, this thing's like, you know, literally 35 years old, with a rating of about 4.6 out of 10. Some critics praised it for its creativity and humor, while others felt that it was a missed opportunity to create a genuinely frightening horror film. And I do believe that with a steadier hand, that concept could have done well. As for the box office of the movie, we don't really know. There's not a lot of information. The movie, according to Box Office Mojo, has only made $808,000. And like I said, the movie didn't do well theatrically, but it did very, very well on home video. In fact, it was released on home video the same year it came out, and it made a lot of money on home video. Hickox had made a comment about how it shipped a lot of units, like a lot of units, at $99 a tape. Now, you got to remember that back in the day, you couldn't buy home movies like that. You couldn't buy movies for your home like that. They were like $100 a pop. That's why video stores would make money off of them by buying them at wholesale value and then renting them out for $3 a night or whatever. And that's how they would get it. That's how they would get their profit. And it's really interesting how it did so well in that market that it was able to then put together enough of a budget to do Waxworks 2, which came out in 1992, which, while it didn't make as much money as they wanted it to, it still was a profit on home video. But unfortunately, Waxworks 3 or anything more within that world was kind of put on hold because of that. And also some of the producers simply didn't get along. There's apparently been some talk of a remake or a reboot of some kind. And, you know, Hickox just wants a cameo appearance in the movies. That's what he has said. And he wants to find someone who could handle like the horror comedy elements of it. But I'm telling you this right here, right now, if you remake Waxworks, do not make it a comedy. Do not make it a horror comedy. Make it a horror. Play it straight. Play it straight. Get a good hand in there that understands the story, understands the tension, understands all of those things, and is able to craft something that is genuinely terrifying. I like horror comedies, but like I said before, I feel labeling something a horror comedy is a cop-out. It allows you the opportunity to not build the tension correctly. It allows you the opportunity to kind of skirt around your responsibilities as a horror filmmaker and go into something campy and laughable simply because it's easy or easier, or it's a get out of jail free card. And I just think you should really try to just go for it and let the chips fall where they may, but at least make the attempt. Don't cop out while you're doing it, right? Like go for Evil Dead. Don't go for Evil Dead 2. Even though I love Evil Dead 2, Evil Dead 2 was intentionally done the way that it was done to be a bit campier, to have a bit more fun with it, and had a lot to do with their love of the Three Stooges and kind of having a bit more fun on the physical comedy side. But the Evil Dead is still legitimately terrifying 42 years later, or 43 years later, basically. You know, so I would say go for that, right? Anyway, those are just my thoughts on Waxworks. If you've seen the movie and you like it, let me know. If you don't like it, let me know. I just want to have a conversation about it. If you guys are listening to this wherever you get your podcasts, please leave a review. You can do that on Apple Podcasts is the probably only way to do it. Follow me on Twitter at Podio Commentary. Follow me on the website, podiocommentary.com. I'll be back next week for the Catherine Bigelow-directed, James Cameron-written Strange Days that dropped in the mid-90s. That should be an interesting throwback to then. And then, of course, finishing out the month, we're going to be doing Jaws from 1975, and that's going to be a fun one as well. Thank you all for your support. Have yourself a great week. I'll talk to you later. My name is Matt Jarboe. This is Podio Commentary. Bye-bye.